This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi tamoto, MPR. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.mpr.nz/donate.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future. Today I have with me...
Richard Meldon.
And I'm Stuart Burks. Now, Richard, you looked into local history to quite a large extent.
I have done. The first real start that I made was for the Kairanga School, 100 years since the centenary of the Kairanga School. And we formed a committee to write a book. I found that committees are not necessarily effective at writing a book, and I finished up doing it myself. So that was that was when I first really started putting something down on paper.
Oh, and how far back would that be?
1989, we did that.
Oh, wow, yes.
So that was, but it took 3 years before that to put all the writing together before the publication was made. So we started early.
Yes, yeah, you have to feel that.
But the idea of history is something that's always interested me because I like old things. Although at home where we grew up as kids, most things were new. If I ever visited down to my grandparents' place, the house was full of old stuff. And it always fascinated me, and there was a lot of old stuff that was tucked away in drawers and things like that. And occasionally I'd go down and just shuffle through the drawers and look at what information I could find, and discovered all sorts of interesting bits of paper and stuff like that. And so interest in something old has been something that always fascinated me. I think it started probably when I first started collecting stamps, and I would have been in about Primer 2 or Primer 3, and I was given a stamp album, and then stamps, we started to collect stamps, and of course the interest in stamps is a lot of the interest because they've got such a history themselves, and stamps were fascinating things. And then I got into coin collecting. Not specialised coin collecting, just whatever I could get. And of course, it's got the names of the countries on it in their own language rather than English necessarily. Yeah. And so they're informative things as well. You learn who the leaders of the countries were at the time. You learn what name those people, what the country was called in their language. And just gradually it went on through like that. Vintage cars was of interest later on. In fact, I'd bought a vintage car before I got my license.
Yeah, because you've restored some, haven't you?
The first one I bought, I didn't restore. It was semi-restored, but it wasn't a particularly good job. But I drove it, and then eventually got my license.
Yeah.
And then bought a that first one was a 1926 Dodge, and then I bought a 1929 Model A Phaeton. Which I did some work on. So the interest in old things has always been fascinating. Old maps, old documents, anything at all like that.
Okay. So in the local history then, what sort of aspects were you looking at? Just what came through from the information?
Well, initially with centenary, of course you're looking at the history of the school, and we were lucky in that respect because we found all the old school logbooks going back to 1889, which was when the school started, where the teacher recorded at least once a week, and often more frequently, a note in the book about activities in the school, individual students by name, which is not done these days in any recordings that, and of course, going through, they went through the First World War and the Second World War, so you learned about the activities that they were doing.
Were there any surprises in that? So, but in terms of the nature of the activities in the school, what they were like?
Yes, they and how widely they roamed as well. from the school during their breaks and things like that. But activities in the school, they didn't start calf clubs, for instance, until the 1930s. But before that, they had art teachers that came in. One of them was actually became a headmaster for a brief period of time, and he was got a mention from the inspector at the time suggesting that he didn't spend quite so much time as teaching them art, because the teacher himself was a particularly fine artist, and he went on to teach art at Boys High School later on. And I think there's some work of him at the school. And he used to do illuminated manuscripts as well for addresses for people of note.
So you look very much there. It was the school history, but then you broadened out into.
Well, a school doesn't just spring out from nothing. A school has to start in a district which has got people in it, and those people have to come from somewhere, and they have to buy land that has got a history before that, and of course, ultimately, it starts off with the from the very earliest times.
Okay.
And so the book, it was very. I very briefly mentioned Maori activity and locally, perhaps not particularly accurately at the time either, because I wasn't particularly well versed in the subject, although I did consult Mason Dury, who was the one of the Maori lecturers at Massey at the time, and he gave me an idea or two about things very kindly. And then I spun it together into a hardback book which covered the school, the district, the social history of the district, the two wars and the effects of the war on the district and the men that were affected.
That's a substantial piece of work. And it's available in the library here?
It's in the library, and I still have copies unsold, which could be available.
So you're saying going on the Maori aspect and so on, and you went way back looking at the history. So
well, yes. After I'd finished the book, I suddenly thought that perhaps I hadn't done the earliest history, the pre-European history, as well as I could have. So I then did some more serious digging, and especially in the Native Land Court records, where all of the proceedings were taken down, and armed with that information, I was able to put together a decent chapter on pre-European history in the Manawatū, and then built on that again with some later history with another publication that was just a private publication. And lately I've been adding to that one again with more political and some of the less
well recognized.
The less popular areas of research. Particularly documents that are not referenced in many books of local history, that give us a slightly different picture of sometimes of what the general knowledge of the place might be.
So could you summarise the current received wisdom and the differences that you've found?
In a short answer, no.
As I understand it, as someone coming here from outside, relations between European and Maori were very good. They were invited in by the Rangitani to form a settlement.
That's the appearance that's given by and it's certainly true that there were chiefs that wished to sell their land, but it really is not my position to speak with my own voice about the Maori involvement. Because they're having their own work done, and that's all coming out in the Treaty of Waitangi settlements that are being made locally as we speak.
Okay, so there's other perspectives that haven't really come through.
Yes, yeah. Okay. Yeah, and it's not my position.
Not for you to say.
I feel free writing about it because I've got documentation. But yes. But to speak freely just like this, no, I won't.
No. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So, what other aspects of history have you found then in terms of the evolution of this area?
Well, it's how the whole idea of the district of Kairanga was evolved out of the province of Wellington, out of the history of the North Island, which evolved through the Treaty of Waitangi. So and it's a matter of finding a trail through the legislation that's been passed, through the documents that have been written, through people's opinions expressed in newspapers and in letters, and finally putting together a story that is in a way quite different from anything that is what we would see as the received knowledge of the Manawatū at the moment.
So the treaty has actually been very important right the way through, because I got some impression of people thought, well, the treaty was in 1840, forget it for a long time, and now it's being revised.
Well, it's certainly true that the treaty was set aside virtually completely in the 1860s, 1861, 1862.
Yeah. Even locally as well as...
there is a little complexity with local business in the 1860s, because the Manawatū in the 1860s, the government brought up the possibility of Māori land being able to be sold directly to Pākehā in New Zealand, rather than have to go through the Crown.
Yeah.
But in the Manawatū, there was a section in the law passed that exempted an area of land called the Manawatū Block from the operation of the Act, which meant then that the province was the only party that could legally acquire land.
Okay.
In that area.
Now, you say the Manawatū Block, was there a Manchester Block around?
The Manchester Block was a part that was included in that.
Yeah.
But the Manchester Block came along later after that section of the Act had been repealed in a later Native Lands Act, so it's not actually, it doesn't fall within the area of the province's exclusive purchase. Yeah, although parts of the land that were the Manchester Block, the province had bought it exclusively.
So for settlement then was the, now I'd heard, let's see, Scandinavians came in, and at first there was a question, do we need people like that here? Or there was some idea of they're good at cutting down trees and forests from Scandinavia. That's how I hear it, the story.
Well, when the government in 1870, and Julius Vogel, he was a minister in the government at that stage. He wasn't the prime minister, but he was in the minister in the government that was instrumental in stimulating immigration, particularly from Scandinavian countries. The superintendent of the Wellington province temporarily left his post and went to Europe to recruit Scandinavians, or to find people who would be the recruiters for him, the agents for him to gather Scandinavians together from Sweden, Norway and Denmark particularly, and they came to New Zealand, and the first ship came in of settlers that were coming to the Manawatū in 1870-71, I'd have to check on that date. And they came up and they were put to work on forest felling clear for the tramway and the railway that was being put through from Foxton to Palmerston North. And they were earning money so that it gave them the potential to then pay off their 40-acre blocks that they were given. Were along the Foxton Highway.
Were they well received?
Yes, in this particular area, I believe they were well received.
Yeah, okay.
They were hard workers, and performed considerable miracles under extensive difficulties, because their land was the land that they had been offered was particularly prone to flooding.
Yeah, and swamps and mosquitoes.
The Manawatu on the one side and the Mungonis stream the Kawau stream on the other both fed a swamp that was essentially the sections that they had been given.
Yeah, okay, very difficult. And there was some issue, what was it, Foxton they thought might develop, and then Palmerston North somehow got the edge, and there was the rivalry between Palmerston North and Maunganui.
Well, that's the whole business with the railways, between the government and private investment with the railways. The original plan was for the main trunk line, or because the government had difficulty buying land on the west coast of the Lower North Island, between Wellington and the Manawatu, the first thrust of the railway was up the east coast side through the Wairarapa. And so that became the government's primary thrust for the main trunk line to go up the east coast side, form a junction at Woodville for the railway coming from Napier, and then for the railway then to proceed on through the gorge.
Okay.
The government then tried, under some pressure, to develop the railway from Wellington up the west coast side. They spent a lot of money and got not much further than Johnsonville before they stopped. There was a commission that was formed to look at the recommendation for the government railways. The commission recommended that the railway line up the west coast wasn't completed, and that they concentrate on the Wairarapa side. Then a private organisation of Wellington businessmen got their heads together and decided to do a private.
Was it along the coast because of Maori ownership of the land, and they didn't want the railway to go through?
The Maoris were unwilling to sell their land to the government.
They were.
And that was the main reason with the government. But they got an edge in because there was a particularly difficult winter, and the Maori were short of food.
Okay.
And the government supplied them, which was a cost to be repaid. In order to ensure the repayment went to the government then took a lien on the land. Because the reason why they did that was because the lien could be, sorry, the cost of the loans that the of the goods that the Maori were given because of the difficult winter were able to be repaid by anybody. In other words, if somebody else got interested in the land, provided they recouped that to the government, they could then buy the land.
Okay.
The government took a lien on large proportions of the land between Horowhenua, Lake Horowhenua, and the Manawatu, which then meant that they had a hold on the land when the Maori wished to sell it. And then after the Wellington Manawatu Railway organisation got themselves going, they got an agreement from the government that the government would supply them with land that they could use to sell on their own behalf to raise funds for the railway. And the government would retain the other portion. The government retained the portion between a midline down the west coast and the ranges, and a lot of the land below that was then offered to the railway people to complete their line.
So the land was actually given up by the Maori, wasn't it?
Ultimately, yes. And it was sold piece by piece.
Is that one of the issues now subject to the treaty settlement?
Almost certainly is, yes. I'm not familiar with treaty details down that far.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so then the land was made available, but then was it the private company that said go to Palmerston North instead of Fox?
Yeah. Now then there was the discussion when the railway company was building the line up. It was going to come as far as Foxton because the government was constructing the tram line from Foxton to Palmerston. And so that seemed like it was going to be a natural end. Mm. They expected then that the route would carry on through Palmerston up to a point where there was a junction higher up that would meet the railway coming through the gorge, and that would then go to Bunnythorpe, and that the junction of all of the lines would be at Bunnythorpe. Now, the government bought land on the south side of the railway line at Bunnythorpe, whereas the Manchester Block owned the land on the north side of the bank of the railway line at Bunnythorpe. And instead of putting the junction at Bunnythorpe that went directly to Whanganui, they decided that the junction of the main trunk line would be at Palmerston. So the trains had to come through the gorge, south back down to Palmerston, and then up to the main trunk line again.
Now, you mentioned Bunnythorpe. Now they're talking about a large development south of between Palmerston North and Bunnythorpe, rail development. Is that the area that they were thinking of originally?
No, that's a little bit to the eastern side of that. The Bunnythorpe settlement on the one side, and the settlement on the other side, which was the Manchester Block settlement, was called Mugby, which was an unusual name, Mugby, and so the junction was going to be at Mugby, and that's come to be called Mugby Junction, which I think is a Dickensian.
Although there's no junction there.
I think it's a Dickensian reference, actually.
And then
the next junction occurred with the Whanganui line up at Marton.
So why was Foxton missed out in the end then? Why did they go to Palmerston?
Well, because instead of the railway line taking what was the existing Foxton Palmerston line, they carried it on up the eastern side of the Manawatu River.
Yeah.
And then came across just below Linton.
Okay.
And that came across to Longburn.
Yeah,
and so so Foxton then was completely left out of the loop, as it were.
And
the port at Foxton gradually lost its trade, and so as a port, it just diminished.
Yeah, and Whanganui felt they were badly done by with all this change.
Well, the line eventually went north from Marton, and Whanganui then became Whanganui to New Plymouth. There was a line from Whanganui to New Plymouth, but it was not on the main trunk line. It was on the New Plymouth branch line.
So really the growth of Palmerston North was more fortuitous on a historical range of reasons why the railway went this particular way.
It may be the reason why it grew as it did. It was always intended to be a reasonable size settlement. Because of the from the original survey that J.T. Stewart had done, Palmerston was going to be a significant settlement, and the fact that a railway from Foxton, which was the port, came up to Palmerston, Palmerston was obviously intended to be a significant settlement anyway.
The railway originally was for taking the timber out, wasn't it?
The Foxton Palmerston Railway. They took timber out, flax and flax as well. Thousands of tons of flax transported out of the swamp country.
And as you were saying, the swamp country actually came a long way inland.
I'm sorry.
The swamp country actually extended a long way inland. It wasn't Foxton area.
The swamp extended. In fact, the railway ran as it came through past Tokomaru and Shannon. All to its western side was all swamp country. And thousands of acres of flax. that was. And once they drained it, because it was swamp, it was swampy country, and but flax doesn't grow in heavy swamp. It requires drainage, and so but still it likes the wet country. And so as soon as they put in effective drainage, the flax just grew enormously.
So, and it's only really been, what, in the past less than 100 years that the flax industry has gone into decline and it's changed?
I can remember flax hanging on the drying racks in the 1950s, possibly up as far as the early 1960s. But and where you used to go over the Manawatu River at Whirikino, the the flax extended up the Motua floodway, what is now the Motua floodway, for miles, as far as you could see.
So what was the image of what would happen in Palmerston? They saw it as a major settlement, but for what? Did they envisage the agricultural research and the university?
No, 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 that all came, miles later. Years later. No, the original, I mean, the reason for the placing of the settlement was that there was a natural clearing in the bush. And that was called Papaioria. That was indicated to the surveyor, and he wrote on his map that it was an ideal place for a township.
Now, also you said they saw Palmerston North as possibly being a large settlement. Is that the reason why there's such a large square in the middle of Palmerston North?
Well, the large square, when it was originally designed, was just a wasteland. Because it takes a long time to develop a town, a township. And developing the township, there wasn't much emphasis put on the square itself. And at times, I think it was seen as a bit of a...
Well, it'd be an anomaly. How many towns would have such a large square in the middle?
Public area in the middle of town.
Wasn't the pressure to develop parts of that, move, have a smaller square?
There may have been. I'm not aware of anything definite to develop it. But it was all I believe originally intended to be public land, and that's and then when the railway came through, it came right through the middle of it. And so it was it was divided in two. I can remember the band rotunda. On the on one side, and then they put a kink in the railway to put the war memorial in, so that it was dead square in the middle of the, rather than put it just to one side of the railway, they put the war memorial right in the middle of the square, which required that they relayed the track around it.
And then so. What was the, now you're living in Fielding, what was the basis for the development of Fielding?
Fielding was one of the planned settlements in the Manchester block. And so when the Manchester block was planned, as a private,
development, a venture.
Private development of farmland of 106,000 acres. And it extended from the Rangitiki River on one side right across to the Manawatu Pahongana on the other side. And Fielding was one of the settlements. There were a number of settlements planned. Halcombe, I think Halcombe was actually planned to be slightly bigger than Fielding because it was in drier country. Fielding was in the middle of a swamp. But it was Fielding that grew.
So what's your view? I know several people have feelings of concern in New Zealand about development on top quality agricultural land, and that's so Fielding could expand without causing those problems. If Palmerston North expands, it does. Would that be correct?
Well, Palmerston expanded onto first class land when it seemed that there was going to be plenty of it, but in fact, the class one soils around Palmerston now, I believe, are protected from subdivision, even though some of it is retained by a dividing agent. But whether that will be
permitted. Is that very recent, the protection then? Of the first
just in the last few years. It's not happened soon enough, actually. And small subdivision as well has done an awful lot to reduce the area of farmable land.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, because all the lifestyle blocks are taking up a lot of...
Right, yeah. Some of the lifestyle blocks, I believe, have done very well with their piece, and they're very productive, but a lot of them are just playgrounds.
Yeah, a lot it's a matter of professionals living in Palmerston, working in Palmerston North and just having a few acres to live in. Yeah.
Around Fielding, and certainly the place that we're on, there's only about 6 inches to a foot of soil on top of yellow clay. It's good for sheep. But it's not arable land. It's not high value arable land. So it's better land to build. Houses on.
Yeah, and the climate here you find better than Palmerston North?
No. We get rain, Palmerston gets rain. We get wind, Palmerston gets wind. The Manawatu, Kairanga, where we came from, we used to get howling gales coming across from the west.
Yeah.
Here in Fielding, up on Mount Taylor, we get exactly the same.
Now, very briefly, because of the time, you've grown up here, over 70, you've seen over 70 years of change in this area.
Yes.
What's your feeling about that?
Well, I suppose change means population growth, and population growth means development. Change is inevitable.
Yes.
Unfortunately, it's not treated as being a sustainable thing.
Yes.
Because population growth is not sustainable. It's exponential. Yeah. And I think that a lot of people are going to get a big fright before too long about how suddenly... we've got a need to expand mightily to accommodate everybody that's here, because we can't do it at the moment.
The scope of population pressure and housing. Yeah. So just very bit, the pluses and minuses of the way this environment has changed for you, in your perception up to now, up to 2021.
It's not something I've really thought about, because I mean, life's just a progress, and you go from one thing to the other as you do it. I've had a lucky life, and I hope there's more of it to come. And
so things like, say, seeing wind farms on the ranges, that's fine. The more cosmopolitan nature of Palmerston North.
One of the things that the Manawatu is really short of is what I would describe as fine landscape. It's a flat area bounded by a range of hills on one side and a lower range, Mount Stewart, on the other side.
Yeah.
And the ranges look different every day when you look at them.
Yeah.
The first of the turbines that went up, I went and looked at them, and I thought, righto, this is progress.
Yeah.
And you sort of think that that's all it's going to be. And then the next lot that were going up, I didn't have anything to do with. And then there was a planned subdivision for turbines just across from Linton, and we fought that.
Yeah.
And won.
Yeah. Okay.
And then we fought again for the Turitea ones, because unashamedly I find that the ranges are something that are a valuable asset, a visual asset to us. I don't care what the landscape architects say about, or the landscape specialists say at the hearings, when they say you can't see the turbines after 10 kilometres or whatever. Yeah. That's a lot of nonsense, because you can see them. I can see the turbines from Bulls, beyond Bulls even, and it's not a natural landscape. But I think now we are going to have to face the inevitable thing.
We'll see more of those.
Yeah, and we will see more of them.
But without the turbines, had they already been deforested and so on? So in some ways, they weren't historically natural.
That's true, and that's one of the big things that the landscape people tell us. It's a modified landscape anyway, so all we're doing is modifying. But it's a modified natural landscape.
Yes.
There are no structures, or there were no structures. And the wind farms do affect the appearance of the ranges.
Yes.
I believe so. But as I said, and much to the disappointment of my sister, I'm going to have to say that it's an inevitable thing.
Yes.
We have a government now that I'm pleased to say is actually doing something about climate change. And we do have to face the inevitable minuses that come with that. And we just have to turn them into pluses somehow for ourselves.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
If you're a fan of NPR, listening to our podcasts and live stream has never been easier. Just search for accessmedia.nz on the App Store or Google Play and download the app with the kiwifruit logo. Once you've got it, pick Manawatu People's Radio from the list of stations and go find your new favourite show.